Live from the heartland and the crossroads of America, it's Tony Katz Today.
Welcome back to Tony Katz Today, folks. Susie Moore filling in for Tony today. Glad to be with you. As I mentioned at the top of the show, there's so much to talk about, and it's hard to even know where to begin. But since this week started out with April Fool's Day, I wanted to talk about that for a minute. I've never been like that big a fan of April Fool's Day. I'm not that creative. I don't like necessarily playing pranks. I don't like having pranks pulled on me. We've entered an era where satire is very, very difficult to discern because things are so crazy already that you can read an article and think, is that real? Am I reading the Babylon Bee? It's hard to know sometimes. We've even got a game here called The Bee or Not the Bee. And, same idea. It's very, very hard sometimes to discern reality from satire. But here we are. And, of course, Monday was April Fool's Day. I saw different versions of, attempted online pranks throughout the day. But one of the ones that really got noticed and wasn't so much a prank as it was a pretty important statement was that of J.K. Rowling. J.K. Rowling, of course, is the author of the Harry Potter books and, a beloved book series by millions. I know when my daughter was young, we read all of the books and really enjoyed them. And she's obviously very well known and very well to do. And that gives her a certain level of power that some people don't have, obviously. But even so, she has in recent years been under tremendous pressure and backlash because she has dared to challenge the transgender narrative that men aren't women and that there is a distinction and a difference between men and women and that biological males, however they choose to present themselves or see themselves cannot become biological females and vice versa. And she has stood firm on that. And often in the face of sneering criticism, threats, just a lot of anger and ire directed at her for daring to say something that a few years ago was axiomatic. I mean, and pretty much anybody that you talk to would agree with that, even while recognizing that there are some people who either experience gender dysphoria or just for personal preference would prefer to be the opposite gender and would prefer to live their lives that way. Now that's not new. The level at which it is being promoted and pursued is very new. So much so that there are some descriptors of it as a social contagion, and it does sort of have that flavor to it. And it's a controversial topic. It's one of those things that people have varying views on. But when you're talking about basic biological facts and trying to persuade people that what they know to be true and what they've always learned to be true just isn't true anymore. That's a difficult thing. And kudos to Rowling for sort of standing up in the face of a lot of that pressure and saying, no, this is where I draw my line. Now, J.K. Rowling is not a conservative. She's not a right winger. I suspect that she and I probably disagree politically on more than we agree on. But we do agree on this, and that is that men are men and women are women, and however somebody chooses as an adult to live their lives, that's on them, but you cannot force others to sort of embrace this non-scientific, non-biological narrative that is now all the rage. So on Monday, she took to Twitter, and she posted a very lengthy thread about, and I'm going to use a little sneer quotes, which you can't see because we're doing radio, but I got a little sneer quotes going on here. Women who were obviously biological men. And she just a whole list of individuals who many of them have committed horrific crimes and now are asking to be treated as women, sent to women's prisons, that sort of thing. She gives a whole, 8 or 10 tweet rundown of all these people. And she's referring to them all as women and as women as women. And she gets to the last tweet and she says, only kidding. April Fool's, only kidding. Obviously, the people mentioned in the above tweets aren't women at all, but men, every last one of them. And then she goes on to discuss that in more detail. What she's doing, of course, is a sort of knowingly tweaking everyone with her commentary. But there's more to it than that, because Monday, a new law went into effect in Scotland. It's called the Hate Crime in Public Order Act, and it makes it a criminal offense to make derogatory comments based on disability, religion, sexual orientation, transgender identity, or being intersex. Now, I think most people could agree that it's not nice to make derogatory comments based on those things. It's not politically correct. It's maybe not even productive. But to criminalize that, to criminalize making derogatory comments is, well, frankly, it's scary. It's scary to think that it's 2024 and a Western nation, an enlightened nation, is enacting legislation that criminalizes speech that is derogatory. And we're not talking about opening up causes of action for defamation. We're not talking about, you know, opening up civil liability potentially for things that are said. We're not talking about people that incite riots. We're not talking about people that, you know, use their words in a way that are fraudulent, that they commit fraud with it. We're not talking about the things that traditionally would be exceptions to the concept of free speech being criminalized. We're talking about just speech because it hurts, basically hurts someone's feelings. And I recognize that the United States is somewhat unique in its having its First Amendment, and that not even other advanced nations don't have that, for instance, Canada. But to think that we've reached a point where it's being criminalized, and don't kid yourself, it's Scotland now, but it's making its way through Europe, and it's making its way through the European Union. It's obviously a thing in Canada, and there's a big push for it here in the United States as well. And that's nothing to be trifled with. Now, the good news for J.K. Rowling is that Scottish authorities have basically said they're not going to prosecute. They don't think that she's truly violated the law at this point. Now, you know, would they be making that commentary if she were just Jane Rowling? I don't know. But we're going to see, since this law just got enacted, the sort of the fallout of this criminalization of speech. And, you know, it's something that's, I mean, I think it should be front and center for any civil libertarian minded person, anybody who respects sort of the basic precepts of democracy, if you will, should be disturbed by that. I mentioned in the last hour, I do these little 1 minute commentaries called More to the Point, and I did one the other day called Shut Up Your Face. I don't know if you remember this, but back in the early 80s, there was a fun little kind of novelty song called Shut Up Your Face. And it was an Italian guy, Joe Dolce, kind of making fun in a loving way of his mom and her sort of sanguine, you know, quit worrying about stuff way, basically saying, shut up your face. And I kind of use that as my jumping off point to talk about the fact that, you know, as a little kid, I was taught you shouldn't tell people to shut up. I was actually forbidden from telling people, from using that terminology. And I didn't really understand it at the time because I knew it wasn't technically a swear word. But I think it was just basically my parents trying to teach me to have good manners and not annoy my older siblings. Be that as it may, it was one of those things where that's not the proper thing to do. And it got me thinking about this impulse we have today in many respects and from many quarters to want to shut up anybody whose views we don't like, anybody who has something to say that we don't want to hear, whether it hurts our feelings or makes us uncomfortable or challenges our ideas or, you know, makes other people think about, rethink how they're looking at things, maybe consider who they're voting for. There's this impulse, whether it's shouting down speakers on college campuses, whether it's big tech companies working hand in glove with governmental entities to silence people or deplatform them or shadow ban them. It's troubling. It's troubling that we're this far along in our evolution as a species, and rather than recognizing that the antidote to troubling speech and things that you don't like being said is more speech and having it out and debating and discussing and talking through things, but just to shut it up, just shut it all up. And that nevertheless is the impulse that we have. It's the impulse that we're seeing from many quarters. And if we're not careful, we're going to find ourselves in a real, real difficult situation, because once you lose that freedom to speak, that starts the breakdown of everything else. That starts the breakdown of every liberty that you have. So it's important to keep in mind. And I just want to say kudos to J.K. Rowling for standing up for that, even though she's doing so on a particular issue. And as I said, not necessarily on all conservative values, but she is standing up for the right, the freedom to speak and the freedom to recognize that there are differences and distinctions biologically between men and women. And I appreciate the fact that since she has that platform, she is using her voice to do that. And we should all applaud her for that. When we come back, we're going to be talking to another Red State colleague of mine, Jennifer Oliver O'Connell. She's got some good articles up talking about some things going on in California, some recent laws there, and also the issue of life, some recent developments in Florida. So stick around. You're listening to Tony Katz Today. Susie Moore filling in for Tony today. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back, folks. You are listening to Tony Katz Today. Susie Morse sitting in for Tony today, and I'm very happy to be joined now by my Red State colleague, fellow writer, Jennifer Oliver O'Connell. Jennifer, thanks for joining me today.
You're welcome, Susie. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. I started to talk about my road trip buddy, because we did just recently have a road trip adventure together. But we only have a short segment, so I won't go into that. I really wanted to have you on today to talk about a couple of things. Most importantly, or maybe not most importantly, but one of the important things, a recent law just went into effect in California about minimum wage, right?
That is correct. The FAST Act. Of all Fast things,
Act.
Always these fun little acronyms from California, the Fast Food Accountability and Standards Recovery Act.
I thought it meant that we were going to have to fast because we're not going to be able to afford fast food anymore.
That may be the case these days. The act has gone into effect. It was voted in by the Assembly and signed by Newsom in September of last year. And it went into effect on, of all things, April Fool's Day. And guess what? people shuttering their doors. One restaurant, a Foster Freeze in Lemoore, California, kind of the Central Coast, basically said, okay, I can't afford to keep you, so handed their people their last paychecks. They've been cutting hours and cutting drivers at Pizza Hut and one restaurant in the San Fernando Valley that I actually ate at before, Shanghai Bistro, pretty much said, we're retiring, can't afford this anymore, see you later. So this is the result. These are just what we're hearing about. We don't know how many others will be closing their doors, but we'll probably see it soon.
Sure. And remind me, this is raising the minimum wage to $20 an hour?
$20 an hour as a beginning. It's supposed to increase every year until up to 2029. So it's $20 an hour in 2024, but it could be $22 an hour in 2025. They expect to keep this incremental increase going.
So the genius economists running the things here in California decided that the way to make sure everybody can afford to live is not to figure out how to bring down prices, but instead to increase the minimum wage. Great.
Exactly. And, they don't care about the whole price fixing thing, that when you fix a price, you basically wipe out that price for any other industry that goes on. You know, I'm not even sure how much, you know, the firefighters are paid these days. Are they even paid this much?
Right. That was really going to be my next question. Is this just fast food workers that this affects, or does this affect every industry?
No,
I mean, it obviously affects everything.
This was specifically instituted and lobbied for by the SEIU, the Service Employees International Union, for fast food workers for California.
Right. And as you point out, then, what do firefighters do? Wait, fast food workers are getting $20 an hour. I need a raise, too. Everybody's going to need a raise, compliments of this.
You got it. And people who are doing jobs than we are.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, And so as goes California, so goes the rest of the nation. So I guess we can look forward to having, you know, jacked up minimum wage for entry level positions flowing across the country soon.
Yeah, that is the plan. I mean, there are places that, you know, are refusing the unions, but unions are getting way more aggressive. In, you know, the place I escaped to, Alabama, they are trying to infiltrate. In fact, they're voting now, to force the auto workers to be a part of the UAW when, you know, people are happy with being able to negotiate their own wages. But unions are, their membership is flagging, and they want more mm-hmm. reasons to gain that union dues while their, you know, executives make, you know, $500,000 a year in order
sure.
to keep that going.
Sure. Why not use the force of the government to make it so, I guess. You mentioned you escaped. Yes. Yeah, so for those who don't know, Jennifer is a relatively recent transplant from California, from which she escaped to Alabama. And I wanted to talk real quick about your neighboring state there. Florida just had some interesting developments with regard to the issue of life. You wrote an article yesterday about their Supreme Court making a ruling and then some upcoming ballot issues. Tell us about that.
That is correct. The six-week, I should call it heartbeat bill, heartbeat life bill was signed into law by Governor DeSantis. It was held up in the courts a little bit. Finally, the Supreme Court ruled that a 15-week ban and adjusting it to a 15-week ban could stay in effect and be in effect in Florida. However, there were enough signatures gathered by the pro-abortion crowd to put it on the ballot that people can vote for either abortion is instituted in the Constitution of Florida or not. So the Democrats and the pro-abortion crowd in Florida are happy that it's going to be voted on. They're pissed off about the Supreme Court upholding the heartbeat bill, but they figure people are, you know, what happened in Ohio and what happened in Kansas is also going to happen in Florida, that people are going to vote for reproductive health, quote unquote.
Right. Well, that does seem to be one of the strongest issues for the Democrats as far as motivating voters. And obviously in a state like Florida, which has become a red state, but only recently so, and there still obviously are, millions of Democrat voters there as well. I'm sure that they are banking on being able to use that as a motivating issue to get people to the polls. And seems to me like the Republicans maybe need to do a better, smarter job of messaging on this issue, because push come to shove, life should be a winning issue. But they don't seem to ever really get a good handle on how to approach the messaging on it.
No, they don't. They need to become united about it. Governor DeSantis has thankfully stepped 10 toes down on his law and said, this is what we need to do. We need to encourage a culture of life. We need to stop the death. And he's done other measures, you know, made adoption easier, fostering a little bit more open. He's done things to encourage people. Let's focus in on life and the children that we have and making sure that they're cared for, and not just, you know, we're not just creating anti-laws, we're creating pro-laws. He's done that. Other governors, and sadly even our Republican nominee for president, keeps muttering about, well, you can't be too restrictive and we got to stop penalizing people, as opposed to, let's talk about the culture of life. Let's talk about those things that Governor DeSantis and Governor Kay Ivey in Alabama and other governors have instituted that
right.
show that we care about life. Promote that.
Yeah. No, I think that's a really good point.
Argument.
Make it a positive message, not a negative message. Jennifer, we just have a couple seconds left here, but in that time, won't you let listeners know where they can find you and your work?
Sure. Redstate.com, obviously. I write there quite frequently. Also, you can find me at 1819 News. Anywhere on social media, if you type in As the Girl Turns, you will find me.
Great. Thank you so much for joining us today, Jennifer. Great talking with you.
Thank you so much.
Folks, stick around. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about that issue of life from a couple different perspectives. It's an important issue, one that we need to keep talking about. So stick around. You're listening to Tony Katz Today. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back, folks. You're listening to the Tony Katz Today Show. Susie Moore filling in for Tony today, and you'll have to forgive me. I hear this bumper music, and I'm transported back to the 90s, and I'm so focused on that. I forget that I need to be talking to you, but I do need to be talking to you about something that's very important. We just touched on it in the last segment with my guest, Jennifer Oliver O'Connell, the issue of life. So as Jennifer explained, Florida recently, there was a ruling by the Florida Supreme Court that upheld the state's 15-week abortion ban, said it was constitutional. And the practical effect of that is that it's going to allow the 6-week heartbeat bill ban to go into effect. That's a bill that bans abortions at 6 weeks with exceptions for rape, incest, and life of the mother. And so that's going to go into effect in 30 days. And then, of course, the issue is going to be relitigated for the next 7 months because it's going to be on the ballot as a constitutional amendment for Floridians come November. This is one of those topics that, well, it makes me frustrated because I feel like it should be an easy win for Republicans. And yet it trips Republicans up over and over and over again. And I should understand that because we're going to get a little deep here, folks. You're listening to someone who used to be a liberal Democrat. That's how I was raised. That's what I was until I was in my late 20s, early 30s. And as that, I was somebody who was kind of one of those tepid pro-choice people. I mean, it was like, well, I would never personally make that decision, but it's not my place to tell other people what they should do. And I thought that was a very nuanced position to have, but really what it was cowardly. It enabled me to pretend like I took a stance on it without really taking a stance. And I never really had to defend it. I mean, if someone challenged me on it, I could kind of retreat behind this idea of me trying to be, you know, fair to everybody and never really have to stand up for it. And honestly, when people did challenge me on that view, it made me bristle. It made me emotional. And it took me a long time to realize the reason I was having that reaction is because it was an important issue and one that I wasn't really coming to grips with. That was that cognitive dissonance in me. It was that disquiet in my belly that was nagging at me. And it wasn't, you know, I wasn't wanting to acknowledge it. I've told this story before, but briefly, my conversion, if you will, from liberalism to conservatism was a process. It didn't happen overnight. But one of the key issues involved in that was the issue of life. And I was debating the issue with a colleague and friend who was conservative while I was still liberal. And we were at lunch and having one of our normal political debates. And the issue of abortion came up. And I made this what I thought was this really strong, you know, meaningful argument was, you know, this was the early 2000s. So I was like, you know, it's been legal in the United States for 30 plus years now. It's kind of a generation and a half of women who've come of age with this expectation and reliance on abortion being legal. And to strip that away would be unjust. And he very calmly looked at me, and he wasn't being snarky. He wasn't being a smart aleck, which is not normal for him. He actually normally was. But he was very serious, and he said, you know, slavery was legal in the United States for hundreds of years. And that was the first time that I ever thought of the parallel between slavery and abortion, and in the fact that in both cases, human beings are being dehumanized and treated as less than full humans. And it stayed with me. It nagged at me. And again, things didn't change overnight for me, but that was really one of those watershed moments in my life that I can look to and point to and say, okay, you know, that's when things really started changing for me. And I think it highlights the fact that on issues like this, you can't just go in with sound bites, and you can't just go in with, I don't know, lofty rhetoric and kind of bash people over the head with it and expect that you're going to change their minds. What really makes a difference is when you prompt them to think, and when you engage with them, and when you ask them to sort of draw out their own reasoning and rationale. That's not easy to do in the middle of a political campaign, obviously. But if you're on the pro-life side, and if you want life to win, if you don't want Floridians to enshrine abortion in their constitution, you've got to learn to be an effective messenger on the issue. And, you know, we've seen time and again Republican politicians get tripped up over it. It happened here in Missouri. I know it happened in Indiana. And it's because the people weren't ready for being challenged, and they didn't. I think maybe they were so cautious and so worried about saying the wrong thing that they overthought it and didn't just speak from the heart. Well, I am here to tell you, if you give people a chance and you talk through things like this with them and you engage them. Now, you know, you can't do that online. You can't do that on Twitter, on Facebook. I get that. But in your day-to-day life, if you're having one of those discussions, again, not the topic that's going to come up at your cocktail party normally or that sort of thing, but when you have that opportunity, it's important to engage with people and say, well, why do you feel like that? Where is that coming from? What do you think is appropriate? And why do you think that's appropriate? And the more you basically use the Socratic method and question people about why they feel a certain way and what that's based on, you may not get them seeing it your way immediately. You may not get much of anything out of them. You may not get a positive response. But it's planting a seed, and it's prompting people to think about it. Because I'm biased because I feel strongly about this, but I think if people really, if you strip away all the politics and all the online wars and the trying to own people and get points, score points. If you take all that away, you just isolate somebody in a discussion about what this really means, what's really at the heart of it. I mean, the big driver of the pro-choice and the pro-abortion movement is this idea that somehow if women don't have that option available, they are going to basically be enslaved. They are going to be lesser second-class citizens because they're going to be, as Barack Obama once put it, burdened with a child. And that's where that's coming from. And, I mean, it's been distorted beyond that tremendously. But that's where that's coming from. But, you got to ask people to really think through what that means and what that, when do they think, a life has value? When does value attach to the life? Get them talking. Get them engaged. Politicians, people who are going to be speaking on this issue in the coming months, they've got to be ready to have those conversations. And they can't let their fear of saying the non-politically correct thing make them go silent. They can't let that make them afraid of addressing the subject. I mean, what issue is more critical than life? We talk about life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. You got to start out with life. You don't have life, you can't pursue happiness. You can't have liberty. It's a very basic, fundamental thing. And yet, for some reason, particularly Republicans, people on the right, have trouble with the messaging on that. My theory is, or my idea of how to address that, is for people to just sit down and think through, well, why do I feel this way? Why do I feel strongly about this? And be ready to defend that and to champion that, not to shrink from it, not to be worried that your words are going to be taken out of context, because they will. If you are running for office, if you are speaking from the right, if you are going on a left-leaning media show, your words are going to be taken out of context. It's going to happen inevitably, but be prepared. Be prepared for that. Be prepared to defend one of the most essential and basic rights of all human beings. And don't shy away from it. Don't be ashamed of it. I just think that we should embrace it. I mean, we pushed for years and years and years and years and years to have Roe versus Wade overturned. Or the proverbial dog that caught the car. Now what? Well, all right. The decision is back with the states. Make the case. Make the case on the local level. Make the case in the states. Make people see that. It's all, we should be championing the culture of life. Jennifer, when she was on with me, mentioned the fact that in Florida, they've been championing adoption and streamlining the fostering process. There are all manner of things that can be done to promote life and show that it isn't just about burdening women with a pregnancy and an unwanted child. It's about giving them opportunities. It's about giving them the opportunity to give life, even if they don't feel prepared, even if they don't think they're ready to be a mother and their ultimate decision is to give the child up for adoption, which is not an easy thing. They have to see that that's a viable alternative, no pun intended. They have to recognize that that is actually a preferred choice. That's giving them the opportunity to give somebody else life. What more precious gift can you give to somebody than their life? That's the way we need to be talking about these things. That's the way we need to be championing it and championing women who find themselves in a difficult situation instead of using it in a, you know, as a negative. There are options. There are opportunities. There are blessings. There are any number of ways to approach this that don't involve terminating a pregnancy and snuffing out the life of a human being. And I don't know. I just, it's one of those things, like I said, I feel passionately about it. I feel passionately about it because of my own journey reaching that viewpoint. And I just think it's something that people on the right, people in the right, should be able to turn into a winning issue if they just take their time with it and speak from the heart. So just want to encourage you to do that. It's going to be an issue. It's going to be talked about a lot in the next 6-7 months, particularly because Democrats think that that's the way they can drive voters. Fear, you know, using fear as a driver, make women afraid that if they don't go out and vote to enshrine abortion in their constitutions or vote for measures that support abortion, that they're going to be kicked back to a second-class status. They're going to be pushing that. It's going to be talked about a lot. Know how you feel about it. Be ready to talk about it and be ready to champion life. We're going to take a quick break here, and then we're going to come back and we're going to talk about dogs. Welcome back, folks. You are listening to Tony Katz today. Susie Moore filling in for Tony today. And I'm going to talk about another topic that is near and dear to my heart. Sort of a little change of pace from the last topic. I know the last topic was a little heavy. It was a little less heavy, but it's still near and dear to my heart. Let's talk about dogs. I am a dog lover. Now, I am an animal lover. I love cats. I love rabbits. I love, you know, you name it. If it's a little furry, fuzzy creature, I love them. But dogs in particular, I have a very soft spot in my heart for them. And volunteer at a dog shelter on Saturday mornings. That's, you know, actually one of the best things I've ever done. It's cathartic. Get a little dog fix. You're doing something good. It's a good thing. So big dog person. Love dogs. So this story caught my eye yesterday. I mentioned Ward Clark before, our Alaska man, and he ran across this story. I'm just going to read you the title because I got a kick out of it. Study. Dogs can associate words with objects. Everyone who owns a dog. Well, duh. Yeah, he's right. I think that's kind of one of those obvious things. Anybody who's ever owned a dog knows that they do associate certain words with certain objects. It's, you know, I'm sure there are some dogs that struggle with that. But most dogs get the idea of walk or treat, that sort of thing. Ward even told a story about a friend of his whose dog could go fetch a beer from the fridge. So that's pretty handy. And obviously the dog is pretty sharp. So this is a study out of Budapest, and, you know, basically it's one of those studies that who knows who commissioned it. At least American tax dollars probably didn't pay for this one, so that's good. But it just kind of confirms what any dog owner, anybody who's familiar with dogs knows, and that is that dogs are smart enough, have the brain power and the capability to associate certain words, the sounds, with certain objects. So that's, you know, I guess it's reassuring to know that we aren't just imagining that. We aren't just attributing that to them. But I think, again, if you've ever owned a dog, you know. They know certain words. But that also brings me to another story that we covered. I think it was over the weekend. This is sort of a disturbing story out of Las Vegas. So there was an incident where police were trying to apprehend a suspect, and they had a canine police dog that was assisting in the apprehension named Enzo. Unfortunately, Enzo was stabbed during a SWAT operation, and they were asking, the Las Vegas police were asking for people to pray for Enzo and see that, you know, that he would make it through and be able to make a recovery. Well, the good news is that Enzo does appear to be making a recovery. Obviously, it was a little dicey, but he is doing well. He is sitting up. He is responding to the treatment, and they think he is going to survive. So that's at least a good thing. Of course, you have to ask yourself, okay, who stabs a dog? Well, turns out the guy that did it, I think he was wanted actually for maybe for murder in Missouri. Not a good guy. And so obviously he doesn't have respect for life of the human or canine variety, but he has been apprehended and I am sure will be receiving justice for his deeds and misdeeds. But it does kind of bring to mind the fact that, you know, you've got not only your animal, your pet dogs, but you've got your trained dogs. Those who serve with the police. And I don't know about you, but every time I see those stories where it's like end of watch for the dogs, it gets me. It gets me. I don't know. It really gets to me. And I'm not elevating dogs above humans. It gets me with humans too. But those dog stories, they get me every time. Calls to mind, I don't know if you all will remember this, but after 9/11 happened, they had rescue dogs. They had, you know, trained dogs that went in with some of the first responders to kind of help with searching, obviously, for victims, but also kind of as emotional support for the responders. I think they served both purposes. I'm not sure if they initially thought that that's what they were going to be doing, but they served an important role. And there was one golden retriever named Brittany, who was a young pup when 9/11 happened. I think she was... Well, they trained for a while. She was probably just shy of 2 years old at the time they brought her up to the World Trade Center site, and she assisted in the recovery efforts and in the support efforts. And she lived for a long time. I think she lived to be, I want to say, 16. I know it was probably going 6 or 7 years ago now when she finally passed away. But boy, oh boy, did I cry when I saw that story. What an amazing story of this animal who provided this important service and this emotional support to the people who were doing a terribly, terribly, terribly tough job. And I don't know, just kind of another unsung hero, I guess, in keeping with the hero theme. So anyway, for all you dog lovers out there, just wanted to treat you to a good news about Enzo, good news about dogs being able to recognize objects, and kudos to all the dog lovers out there. We're going to be back after the top of the hour here. Tony Katz today. Susie Moore filling in with him. We'll be back right after this.